This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. If you read only mainstream news sources, the dire state of the world is usually on full display. Less covered are the ways in which people are fighting back against oppression and injustice in their communities. But Ijoma Oluo, writer, speaker, and best-selling author of So You Want to Talk About Race, has an abundance of such stories in her new book, Be a Revolution, how everyday people are fighting oppression and changing the world, and how you can too. Oluo's work on race has been featured in The Guardian, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many other publications. She was named to the 2021 Time 100 Next list and has twice been named to the Root 100. She received the 2018 Feminist Humanist Award and the 2020 Harvard Humanist of the Year Award from the American Humanist Association. I had the chance to speak with her recently about her new book, Be a Revolution. Welcome to the program, Ijoma Oluo.
Hi.
Your book is a wonderful delving into the ways in which people can make change in this country. But you open your book saying that after you wrote your first two books, So You Want to Talk About Race and Mediocre, that you, quote, felt wrung dry. How did the act of being in community give you the impetus to write this new book?
You know, it was a really important reminder of the why. I think it's really easy to get caught up in what we're fighting, you know, the horrors that we're trying to prevent. But what we're trying to build, what we're trying to protect, what we're trying to nourish often ends up getting kind of pushed aside. And it was really important for me to be able to reconnect with community, with the movement workers and community members who were responsible for my own well-being, you know, who had cared for me and my family through hard times. And it really helped me remember that there was a lot of joy, there was a huge gift, and that our survival was a testament to this important work, and that a lot more time and attention needed to be paid to that, you know, these acts of love and service.
So you ended up being very encouraged by the work that individuals were doing, work that's, of course, often not covered by our mainstream media because it's not clickbaity enough, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Media really wants to see anguish, hardship, shouting, violence. And all of that, of course, ends up being a part, unfortunately, you know, of this sort of work. But so much of what sustains us day to day, so much of what makes the work that we see on cameras possible is the everyday, quieter, loving, and very, very difficult, but also very rewarding work that people have been doing, you know, for multiple generations.
Now, from your book title, it's not obvious that you center the idea of abolition when you talk about race and oppression. And I was really excited to see that you just jump right into it in your first chapter. And you say that one of white supremacy's greatest weapons is the war on imagination. How do we unfetter our imaginations to embrace the idea of abolishing the carceral state, something that, you know, especially before 2020, people just dismissed as being an idea far too radical?
I think it's important, first of all, to realize that there are large segments of our populations who have never been able to rely upon the state and upon established systems for our well-being. And so alternatives are already being built and already working, already keeping us together, keeping us whole. And that story of those is being erased in order to feed this narrative that there's nothing to be done, that what exists as these, you know, set functions and set systems is the best we can hope for. And so I recommend first, if you want to kind of unlock the potential of your imagination, is to see where people who've been forced to do so, people who've had no choice because the systems that exist not only don't serve them, but often harm them. what they've been able to create, and then ask, okay, so what if we took away even more barriers to this? What if we supported this? What if we were able to all bring our talents and skills to this? What would we be able to come up with? And so I recommend to start there, and I hope that for people reading my book, that they'll start to see some of the amazing creativity and imagination that has gone into problem solving in our communities and building and investing in our communities, where we've had no choice because we haven't had access to a lot of the systems that, many people are being told is the only option available.
Tell me about Richie Reseda. He's one of many individuals that you profile, who you profile in your book, Be a Revolution, as doing this empowering, important work that, again, gets left out of mainstream media. Who is Richie?
Richie is someone whose work I've admired for a long time. And he is someone who, at a very, very young age, he's a Black man, a Black and Jewish man from Los Angeles area, and had been caught up in our prison industrial complex from a very young age. And yet, through the tutelage of community leaders who really believed in him, regardless of what he was caught up in, who believed in his potential, helped him, helped educate him. And then, his own belief in himself, even while incarcerated, was able to develop a program to really help other men caught up in the system, especially Black and brown men caught up in the system, to divorce themselves from violent patriarchy and understand how that violent patriarchy was contributing to harm that they were causing to themselves and their community, and harm that was being done to them. And it was so beautiful that he was able to build this organization, that sought to find whatever measure of freedom and growth was available to these men while incarcerated. And built it for other incarcerated men. And it is something that's has been existing for years now, that now he has handed over leadership to other men, and it has now expanded even beyond California. And to me, it's such a beautiful testament of how people, when they believe in themselves, are given some support from community, are given some knowledge about how our systems work, can create amazing things that really help free other people, even while most of society has tried to cast them away.
Tell me also about Ian Head. Not all of the people profiled in your book are people of color, and it's so important to understand what solidarity really looks like in a way that doesn't center dominant groups. So tell me about Ian Head.
I think it's quite fitting for Ian, being one of the white people profiled in the book, that he was really hesitant to be profiled in the book. He really did not want to take up space. And we had to really have conversations about how important it was for white people who were doing work and supporting and aiding our communities and aiding injustice work in a responsible way to really show how it can be done. And his story was so beautiful to me, is so beautiful to me, of a white man who grew up in a predominantly white area and fell in love with hip hop and the stories of hip hop, and was touched by these stories that often talked about things like police brutality and systemic oppression, and was motivated to try to create change and to do so in a way that was, responsible with his privilege. And so he aligned himself with legal aid groups and did some very, very important work, not only in the New York stop and frisk case, but also in helping to empower incarcerated people in prisons across the country. And I just love his ethos around it, his insistence on being of service and not centering himself, and how much amazing things he was able to accomplish that a lot of people don't know about because he really is quite quiet about it.
And we need more people to engage in that sort of solidarity, right? Because as we've seen in the past with, say, mainstream white feminism, for example, solidarity around issues of race It's been difficult, especially for liberal white feminists. And so to get the example of how to get solidarity, especially on issues of racial justice, how to get it right is an important example.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when we look at media around these issues and you look at films like The Help, right, these are all very white-centered narratives. And the idea is that you're going to come to the rescue and you're going to be the hero of a story. And that's not really how that works. When you start doing work as a quote unquote ally or an accomplice, the first thing you're going to come up against is your own complicity and how deep it goes and how deeply you've been programmed by white supremacy to do harm and participate in harm and to be ignorant of harm. And that work is continuous, and it requires a lot of humility and a lot of commitment to actually being in solidarity with communities and being in community in order to do that work. But I think also, even in looking at stories like Ian's, what you'll see then when you do engage in the work from that really authentic place of first, you know, saying, I'm going to acknowledge where I am, I'm going to be open to feedback, I'm going to be responsible, I'm going to do work where I'm asked to do work, you find a deep connection to community that I don't think is open to a lot of people otherwise. And, you know, listening to the joy in which, you know, Ian describes his work and, you know, the real connection to community he has, I hope that's something that people will look at and understand that you don't have to be the hero of the story in order to get a lot out of this work. You just have to be willing to foster genuine, honest connection that also requires that you take a good look at yourself.
One of the most important aspects of your book is examining disability justice, which I think is this issue that is slowly coming to the forefront because of the work of disability justice activists, and particularly around systems of oppression, policing, incarceration, and law enforcement. Tell me why this was such an important issue for you and what we all, whether we're able-bodied or not, what we all can learn from the disability justice movement.
I will definitely say, after having these discussions and years spent in community, but especially working on this book and talking with so many BIPOC disability justice workers, is they really are at the forefront, not only of our liberatory work, but as far as our definitions of freedom and bodily autonomy, I think that they are as close to honed in on what that means as anyone else, because they're often the most targeted, especially when you're looking at, you know, the kind of intersectionality of disabled BIPOC, especially Black and Indigenous disabled people. And so their definition of freedom really goes down all the way through challenges of capitalism, you know, looking at ableism and racism and how they're intertwined. And it's so important when I start having these conversations for me to realize that it is all connected, that any threat to our autonomy, our bodily autonomy, anything that says that some people have the right to determine who is of value and who isn't, who is free and who isn't, you know, who deserves to have safety and who doesn't, is a threat to us all. And it is really in disability justice, especially, I would say almost exclusively, Black and brown disability justice circles, where that is being made very, very clear. And it is really important because it touches on us all, and the systems will find different ways to say, for many different reasons, that some of us are, you know, found mentally deficient of full citizenship and full respect and safety here, or physically deficient. And these justifications may be racist, classist, you know, all these different things, but at heart, they're ableist. And as we are looking at a world profoundly and continuously impacted right now by the COVID pandemic, as we are looking at an event that is disabling millions of people right now, I would say we have to take this more seriously than ever.
And tell me about Willisa Thompson, who and her work in bringing to the forefront that really important intersection of racial justice and disability justice.
Yes, Velissa Thompson was the social worker, correct? I'm sorry,
Yes,
34 people.
she
34
wrote the
people.
I know.
Macro social work. 34 people in a book. So I'm like, yes. Velissa Thompson's work is really amazing. And I would say what's really interesting is when we talk about abolition and we talk about systems that do harm, we're often keeping that focus really narrow in broad conversation, right? We're usually just talking about prisons. But looking at the ways in which institutions like our social work institutions have contributed to carceral harm. And the way in which abolition work needs to look at things like this, things that purport to help our communities but actually do a lot of harm, and look at the ways in which Black and Brown people, but especially Black and Brown disabled people, are trying to challenge that and say, no, absolutely not. If we're going to help communities and we say we're going to help on a social level, we really must challenge a lot of assumptions, and we must stop just looking at an individual and start looking at the ways in which society is really contributing, if not creating, the problems that people are facing. And so, Velissa's work, I think, really challenges this idea that a social worker can come into a home, especially a disabled home, with people of color in it, and say, you need to do this, or you need this, or you have a problem, and therefore you aren't fit to be here or have children here, and instead says, what is the situation we're seeing here? How is society contributing to this? How are our systems contributing to harm? And what is your definition of safety and freedom and success? And how can we help you meet that? And so her work to really challenge that and bring it to the system itself, because this is a field that she has chosen, I think is super important. And it is a really great example of how you can take the work that you are doing or your interest and say, let me apply, liberatory practices, anti-racist, abolitionist practices to this and see what change I can make.
Another really important thread and theme in your book is around labor and capitalism. Again, huge, huge issues. And we don't, up until a few years ago, just didn't see enough discussion around racial capitalism or how economic inequality is an issue of racial justice. And I love that you profiled Chris Smalls, up and coming powerhouse young labor organizer. Do you think that this front in organizing around oppression is getting enough traction where people are really starting to see through the failures of capitalism, and we're seeing leadership from young people of color especially?
I would say on one level, absolutely. Well, I would say yes, across the board, we really are. But we're also seeing with that, of course, some real backlash and resistance to that because of the change that it represents. So I would absolutely say our younger generations, right? I am 43, and seeing people 5, 10, 20 years younger than me, even teenagers, have a really clear understanding of how disastrous capitalism has been and how little investment they actually have in it because they don't see a future in it. And they understand how racist it is. They understand how ableist it is. A lot of that is the work of these young organizers, and a lot of it is motivating these young people to become organizers and movements, and movement leaders. But we're also seeing traditional labor really resist that and feel threatened by that because their power kind of lies in this very patriarchal white supremacist structure that claims to be, liberatory, but really is only for a select few in the working classes. And therefore, it's not effective at all. When you are excluding or alienating a huge part of your workforce because it threatens traditional white supremacist patriarchy, you are not effective, especially on a labor organizing perspective. And we've seen that. We've seen how vulnerable it has made our labor movements to, pro-business, anti-worker politicians, and over the past decades, and it has severely weakened our unions. And they really haven't been able to lean into worker power because they haven't actually shown that they support workers, especially the workers most vulnerable to these corporations and politicians. And so seeing this revival that's really built, on the needs and the frustrations and grievances and the hopes and dreams of this diverse and informed intersectional group of young workers is probably the most revitalization that our labor movement has seen in decades. And I really hope that they're able to keep it going. I hope that they will have enough support to be able to withstand all of the counter pressure being placed upon them. And so far, I mean, they're doing amazing work. If we look at the stories around Starbucks, just now agreeing to come back to the table and meet with unionizers because these boycotts have been so successful. When we look at Amazon and the success it's been having, when we look around the country and the way in which young people are saying, absolutely not. My labor means something, and I am a human being, and I deserve care. And we will not be exploited anymore, and we will have a say in how this works. And it's going to be, a say that has women, people of color, non-binary people, disabled people at this table as well. It's just a really beautiful thing to see that I hope that people of my generation and older can see, embrace, and support.
Yama, I could talk to you for so much longer about your book, but I encourage our audience to pick it up themselves. But I wanted to veer a little bit outside your book for one last question to you, which is that you and I are talking at a time when there is a US field genocide happening on the other side of the world. And I know you've been very outspoken on social media around that. You've been punished by the algorithmic gods of the, algorithmic overlords, if you will, for being outspoken. You're not Palestinian, I think, and yet you and so many other people of color and young Jewish folks are speaking out very prominently in solidarity with Palestinians. Why is this a central moral issue of our time, this massacre happening again on the other side of the planet?
There's multiple reasons why. One, I would say that the settler colonial project that has been the occupation of Palestine has been heavily invested in by our major capitalist powers, right? By the United States, by Britain, by Canada, as a part of their global colonialism. And the weapons formed to maintain this violent occupation have also been used against our Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities around the world. And we are seeing those connections. We understand this. We understand that it is not just Palestine, right? So on a moral level, I think that we're all outraged, terrified, shocked, and we want it to stop because these are human beings. But also on an intellectual level, we know that every justification used for this genocide is also used against us and used to justify, locking our people in prisons. It's used every time that a Black person is killed by police or a disabled person is killed by police. It's used against, protesters right now who are trying to stop Cop City down in Atlanta. And we know that our liberation is tied. And we also can see clearly in this project how our oppressors work together and that they see common fate, that they know. There's a reason why it's not just that Black and Brown people around the world are saying this must stop and we understand that this has to stop and that all of our safety is tied in it. We're also seeing these very oppressive powers coming together and saying this must succeed. This genocide must be allowed to continue because they understand that the more that we know how these systems work together, the more that we can see the ties of capitalism and global colonialism into this violence and oppression, that it all falls. That I think right now it's been amazing to me, and in the midst of all of this horror, is watching so many people who really thought that this was a Middle East issue, saying, I had no idea that the United States could use our tax dollars to support this, that it was so strategically important to our colonial project itself that we would be sending billions of dollars to this. People who had no idea that, Israeli military and United States police officers were training together and sharing technologies. People who had no idea that we would, bomb a country for trade while protecting a genocide, right? That we care so much about the movement of money and power, that we would decide that that is a threat while an ongoing genocide is not. And so watching people now understand what our government does, now seeing these poll numbers showing that the vast majority of Americans want a ceasefire, and yet watching all of our politicians insist that a ceasefire would be dangerous to us, and that continuing this violence is in, our best interest, even though overwhelmingly people know it is not, across party lines. It's really opening people's minds. It's opening people's eyes to how corrupt our system is, to how much it has failed us, to how little it actually represents us, and actually how much harm it causes. And it must stop. I'm so terrified for the people of Palestine. I'm so heartbroken for the people of Palestine. And I hope that our actions can be enough to stop this genocide. But I do see there's no coming back from this. You can't unknow this. And the people are seeing every day, more people are waking up to how corrupt and horrific our systems really are, and our government is, and that it must change, because it will not end with Palestine. Even if we can't stop this genocide, it doesn't end there. And all of our safety is tied in saying that not only can this never happen again, but that these systems do not deserve this power. They do not speak for us, and they do not deserve to say that they speak for us.
Right. Everything is tied together. And as many great people have said before us, none of us can be free until all of us are free, right?
Absolutely.
Ijoma, thank you so much. It's been an honor. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
Ijoma Oluo is the best-selling author of So You Want to Talk About Race. Her earlier book was Mediocre: The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America. And we've been discussing her latest book. It's out January 30th, 2024, and it's called Be a Revolution: How Everyday People Are Fighting Oppression and Changing the World, and How You Can Too. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.